מאב, ברוך השמיים.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome back to Tom's Talmudish. Tonight we are beginning a new series, a series on a very, very interesting mitzvah in the Torah called Sfirat HaOmer. It's a mitzvah of counting days. It is a commandment in the Torah that on the morrow of Pesach, we begin to count. We count 49 days. The 50th day is celebrated as Shavuot. This is the anniversary of the giving of the Torah. Before I begin, I just want to suggest that if you're watching on Facebook, you might want to come over to YouTube because you have better sound and you can ask questions. And I do watch the chat, so that's one reason. And the other reason is it's easy to find after. If you haven't yet subscribed, please do so. That's youtube.com/Avi Mendel Kaplan. Thank you. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge tonight's sponsors. Felix and Rita Zilnick are dedicating this class to the memory of Rita's father's yahrzeit. His name was Yona ben David. His yahrzeit was observed this past Shabbat. May his neshama have an aliyah, and may he have nachas from the Torah being studied in his merit. Amen. Okay, so when we study Talmud, we are not going to get a background per se. That's not how Talmud works. We're not going to get, so there's a God, and he decided to create the world. And then there was Jewish people, and then there was Abraham, and they went into Egypt. We're not going to do that. The Talmud does not give us that background. The Talmud just dives straight into it. Talmud is a book of law. These are the oral laws that were given to Moses. And the Mishnah is written usually in relatively cryptic form, and it has to be further opened or developed and understood, and that's the Gemara. Mishnah and Gemara together, that comprises Talmud. So without further ado, and without a lot of background that's what Talmud is, even though we have some new students here tonight, I say let's get right into it. And if you have questions, ask them. And as we begin to learn, we will appreciate and understand. So, the mitzvah is that on the night after Yom Tov ends, that we start to count. And on that first day we say, today is one day of the Omer. The next day we say, today is 2 days of the Omer. And then we do this for 49 days. And we make a bracha, and it's a mitzvah. What is the Omer? What does it mean counting the Omer? So the simple answer is that the Omer is a chalice. It's a measuring cup. And it was used in temple service in the Beis HaMikdash. We know that the Omer had a certain ability to capture the imagination of the Jewish people, and that it was a meaningful image, because on some of the Bar Kochva coins, we find the Omer chalice. So there's an image of the Beit HaMikdash, and there's an Omer chalice, and a lulav and an etrog. Of course, we, the Jewish people, are not permitted to make graven images. So we didn't have raised reliefs of the king or the queen or somebody else very important in the country in the way that coins were manufactured during the time, during the day. So we were the only nation who had currency, but the currency did not feature a human, but rather either buildings like the Beit HaMikdash or artifacts, things from the Beit HaMikdash that would capture people's attention. And this was a way in which Bar Kochva and the government that he had set up, the provisional government that he had created, was able to inspire the people. The currency wasn't just used for money. The currency was used to stimulate people's spirits, to uplift their hopes, and to make them yearn for the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash and the return of temple service. So the chalice is one of those things that we have. Interestingly, we don't have Keruvim and Aron. We don't have a golden table. We don't have a menorah featured in any coins. Why not? Because the Torah says you're not allowed to make its likeness. And even though in today's day and age we do have many pictures and images, but this is much later on when Jewish people got a little more comfortable with the Beit HaMikdash, and sadly enough, and its loss. And we knew that we weren't going to be replacing the Beit HaMikdash. We couldn't do this. So So that's when we softened in replicating certain things, but still, even in today's day and age, it is forbidden to replicate the actual menorah of the Beit HaMikdash. And this is, incidentally, the reason that there's been many, many archaeological finds that seem to confirm a menorah with round branches, but very few that depict a menorah with an angular branch. There's actually only one archaeological drawing that was discovered about 15 or 20 years ago, I think in 2006, maybe a little earlier. And so the reason is, I mean, Rambam says he has a tradition that the menorah was angular. Rashi uses the term angular when he describes the branches of the menorah. And some of the rabbis who said round only said round because of Titus's ark. They said, well, apparently it's round. So the simple answer is that there was only one actual menorah, and the Romans didn't get that one. They got another menorah. And people would make images of menorah, but not the menorah of the Beit HaMikdash. But the Torah does not deem the Omer to be a sacred artifact. So the chalice, it wasn't like there was one chalice, it was a chalice. It was used in the Beis HaMikdash. It was the primary measuring cup. And therefore, because the chalice or the Omer was something that they could replicate, it shows up on coins. And there's a lot more to say about that, but that wouldn't really address the subject of tonight, which is about counting days and specifically the reaping. Here's the point I want to make. The mitzvah is to count the days from the bringing of the Omer. And this Korban Omer was a grain offering, what we would call a meal offering, fresh grain that from the new harvest. It had never been brought before. And an important detail to know is that until an offering is made in the Beit HaMikdash of the new harvest, we are not permitted to eat from the new harvest. First, you give to God, and then you can enjoy. This is a mindset. It's an attitude the Torah wants to inculcate within us, a sense of reverence, a sense of awe for God. It's like, I don't know if you've ever seen that people have in a business, the first dollar they make, they tape it onto the wall, or they laminate it, and they keep it. It's like a good luck charm or something. Of course, this is not about good luck, but this is about remembering that any success that we have is a gift from Hashem. And we are able to demonstrate that when, after many, many, many hard months of labor and toil, you finally have produce, something's grown, and before you partake of it, you give some to Hashem. That's the idea of the Omer. There are those who erroneously think that the Korban Omer, the offering, triggers the counting. That's factually incorrect. Now, they'll point to this, reality within Jewish law, that most authorities tell us that today's mitzvah of counting the Omer is only rabbinic because we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. And the mitzvah is to count. They say, well, there was no Korban brought, so the mitzvah isn't the biblical mitzvah, but that's not actually true because we would count the Omer before we brought the Omer anyway. The Omer has to be counted the night before. And the Korban wasn't brought, or the offering, the Mincha, wasn't brought till the next day. In the Rambam's words, when he enumerates the mitzvahs in the beginning of the laws of Tmidim and Musafim, which are the laws of the regular and unique offerings in the Beit HaMikdash, the Rambam has his special system of listing all the mitzvot that he's going to cover in every set of halachot. This is in the 8th book of Mishneh Torah, which is called Sefer Avodah, means the book of service. And the Rambam, in the mitzvahs that speak about Pesach, he says mitzvah 11 of this section is the special offering for Pesach. Mitzvah 12, lahakriv omer hatnufa, to offer the wave omer, the omer, the chalice which was waved. And that's, again, a subject for a different day, what that means, that it's waved. I actually have a class online, and you can search and Google it and watch it. It's very interesting. Why do they have to wave the Omer, and why this business of waving is so important? But then the next mitzvah, which is mitzvah 13, and I'll read you the words of the Rambam to be precise. Lispor kol ish ve'ish shiva shavuot. It is a mitzvah for each person to count 7 weeks. Miyom hakravat ha'omer, from the day. You're counting from the day. You're not counting from the bringing of the Omer. You're counting from the day of the Omer. What you couldn't do until the Omer was brought was actually eat the new grain. Incidentally, there's a big question of what we do in today's day and age. There are many halachic authorities who maintain that in today's day and age, one is not permitted to eat chodosh, or the fresh harvest until the second day of Pesach passes. And that can be problematic outside of Israel, because the agricultural cycle is not a precise in outside of Israel as it is in Israel. And here they're able to harvest grain earlier. So you may end up with Chodesh Cheerios or pretzels a month before Pesach, and that can be a problem. Of course, there's a big dispute whether this applies outside of Israel altogether. And of course, in today's day and age where there is no korban, we would say you have to wait for the day of the korban. So this is a little bit of background. And I'm sharing some of this background with you because it's going to be necessary to appreciate and understand what we're going to learn about in the Mishnah. We will be learning about counting the Omer. The Gemara is going to talk about that. This is a series that's about Sefirah to Omer, about counting days. However, you cannot, in fairness, learn about counting days of the Omer without learning about the Omer. So that's why this Mishnah, I've chosen to start the series on Daf Samache, which is page 65 of the Gemara, 65a. It's the sixth chapter in a Mesechet, in a tractate called Menachot. Menachot is a plural for a mincha. A mincha is the name that the Torah uses for grain offerings, for plant offerings. In the Beit HaMikdash, there were animal offerings. There were mineral offerings, like water or salt, for example. And then there were many things which are organic, things that grew from the ground. Whether it was a wine libation, and of course wine grows from the ground, or flour that could be kneaded with oil or water, or sometimes just actual grain that could be roasted. A variety of different things that we could use the grain for in the Beit HaMikdash. So the question then is, when is the first observance? When do we actually do something about the Omer? When we do something about the Korban. The Korban has to be brought on the day after Pesach, on the day after the celebration of what we call the Exodus. So the next day, we bring this Korban. And the question is, when is the first legal or the first technical observance of this mitzvah? You would be perhaps thinking, on the day you bring the korban, on the day you bring the mincha. Yeah, but that doesn't work because grain doesn't harvest itself. And fresh grain doesn't easily allow itself to be made into flour either. It's moist granola. You have to crack the husks and you have to grind the grain and you have to get flour. And that doesn't happen so quickly. Typically, when we harvest grain, we have to dry the grain. The grain usually cures naturally. In Hebrew, the term for summer is kayetz. And the meaning of kayetz in biblical Hebrew is to cure or to dry out. In Israel, it doesn't rain during the summer. It doesn't rain that much altogether. But even in the winter, they don't get usually oftentimes as much rain as they hope for or want. But in the summer, it doesn't rain. I remember years ago, I had some cousins from Israel. And, it came as people come from Israel. They figured it's summer. They know Canada's a cold country, but it's... And they were, like, freaked out. It was one of those Junes where, like, every 3 days it was just like a thunderstorm. Like, what is going on over there? It tells me, Maze, is it Yimotag Shamim? I said, Yimotag Shamim. You should only know what winter's like here. They said, in Israel, it doesn't rain. It's from Pesach to Russia, there's no rain. Which is a great thing for things like harvesting, because you can leave everything out in the field, and there, under the blazing heat of the sun, it naturally cures, and then Sukkot comes along, which is Chag HaAsif, and we bring everything into the silos and into the granaries. So this is going to take work. It's going to take work. If we're going to make flour out of fresh granola, out of grain which is moist, that has just grown, it's going to take work. It's going to take work to harvest it, and then it's going to take work to roast it unnaturally because we don't have time for it to dry out. And then we actually have to make sure that it turns into grain. And it has to be very fine grain, which means that it was sifted and sifted and sifted a number of times until we had this very, very fine grain that was used. As such, the first observance of the mitzvah of the Omer, which is related to the counting of the Omer, you would think is on the eve after Pesach, when you have to cut it. So the Mishnah tells us actually not. Let's take a look inside the Mishnah and let us learn together. So the Mishnah begins with a question, Ketzad. How did this happen? In the previous Mishnayot, we learned a little bit about what the Korban Omer is, and now we're getting technical. Okay, how does this happen? Ketzad Einosin. How did they make this happen? So the Mishnah now begins to explain. The Mishnah says, Shluchei bet din yotzin me'erev yom tov. Agents or emissaries representing the high ecclesiastical authority of the Jewish people known as Sanhedrin, which interestingly is a Greek word, but that's the way we called the high court during the time of the Second Temple, and that's the name that stuck. The Sanhedrin would send special agents, Erev Yom Tov. Erev Yom Tov means day before Pesach. That's the day when we bring the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering. Why would they do that? The Mishnah says, Ve'osin otan krichot. They would make bundles. They would make bundles. But usually you make bundles after you harvest the grain. We don't want to harvest the grain yet. So why are you making bundles? So the Mishnah says the bundles would unusually be made b'mechubar lekarka, when the stalks were still planted in the ground. Who makes bundles when it's still attached? Why make bundles? You bundle things that are separated, disconnected. Says the Mishnah that this was done kedei sheyehei noyach liktzor. It should be easily cut. Now, if you've ever seen how people used to harvest once upon a time, there would be, you take an armful of stalk, you had a sharp sickle. The sickle is round. Most people still know what the sickle looked like because that was the sign of the Soviet Union. That was once the worker sign, right? That's how I know what a sickle looks like. And the sickle would be, which was round, would come around and you'd cut the entire stalk that way. And then you could either bundle it, or you can let it drop to the ground and somebody else would come and bundle it. And that's how they would move through the fields. Now, this takes time to gather the grain. We seem to be very short on time here. We want to make this as efficient as possible. So in order to make it as efficient as possible, we make the bundles before, so when they come to cut the grain, they don't have to make a bundle. You don't cut stalks one at a time, you cut bundles. So the bundles are made. And all you have to do once the bundles are made is simply a quick slice. Sounds like they do things very quickly. Ah, now we're in for a surprise. Because apparently, it doesn't go quickly at all. But we'll see in a moment. I want to talk to you for a minute about Shluchei Bezdin. Who are Shluchei Bezdin? What does that mean? Why is the Bezdin appointing agents? There are certain mitzvot in the Torah which apply to individuals. Some of these mitzvot govern the way we think. For example, the mitzvah of believing in God, or the mitzvah of knowing about the oneness of God. Some mitzvot govern the way we relate to others. Like it says in this week's Torah portion, how should you relate to others? V'ahavta l'reach kamocha. You should relate to them with love. And what shouldn't you do? You shouldn't nurse grudges. And you shouldn't harbor anger. So that's a mitzvah that tells us not how to think, but how to feel. Then there are mitzvahs that tell us what to say. For example, counting the Omer is a verbal mitzvah. You have to verbalize it. And then there are mitzvahs in which we are commanded about things to do or things not to do. For example, the Torah says put on tefillin. The Torah says affix a mezuzah. The Torah tells us share of your wealth with those who are needy, tzedakah. Those are things to do. What shouldn't you do? Don't take somebody else's money. That's called stealing. What else shouldn't you do? Don't violently assault anybody. Striking somebody in a violent way is a violation of the Torah. So there are things to do, things to think, things to feel, things to say, and things to do. This is Rambam's words. Maimonides talks about the mitzvahs like this. Yet, there are some mitzvahs that apply to every one of us as individuals. Most of the mitzvahs I just mentioned are mitzvahs that are incumbent upon us. What happens if I don't have love in my heart? That's my problem. Of course, all of us are in this together. So if I'm not behaving right, it affects all of us. And if any one of us is doing what should be done. The entire nation is enriched by it. Every chain is only as strong as its weakest link. We're all woven together. So we all have to try to work on ourselves. Are we responsible for each other? Yes. By and large, yes. There's a mitzvah, an idea, a concept called arvut. So we are responsible for each other. And that means we should care about each other. We should care if somebody doesn't have food to eat, doesn't have a place to sleep. We should also care if somebody doesn't know about Yiddishkeit, somebody doesn't know about mitzvahs. Try to share the mitzvahs. Does that mean you should judge people and yell at people and scream at them? No, that's not effective. That's not a good idea. You should care. You should care. It should make a difference to you. So the personal mitzvahs are personal mitzvahs. You should care about somebody else's personal mitzvahs, not your mitzvah. Then there are mitzvahs that are incumbent upon a nation. National mitzvahs. Like, for example, what they call the daily double. There used to be two offerings brought every time, every day the sun rose in the Beit HaMikdash. There was a Tamid Shel Shachar, a morning offering. And there was a Tamid Shel Bein Harbayim. So who enforced that these offerings would be brought? They were brought on behalf of the entire nation. Every one of us had a mitzvah to give a half a shekel. And the half a shekel would be collected in these giant drums. And then these half shekels would be used to purchase the offerings that were brought on behalf of every single member of the Jewish people. But whose mitzvah is it? It's a mitzvah for all of us to contribute. It's brought on our behalf. Whose responsibility is it to make sure that the korban actually gets brought? Who's responsible? You know, if you want something to get done, somebody has to be responsible. And the simple answer is, the Sanhedrin is responsible. Whoever has that position is responsible. So if our leadership fails, we are all impoverished as a result. If our leadership succeeds, we are all enriched. Because those are mitzvot that the Beth Din does on our behalf. One could argue that the Beth Din are agents of the nation. And that the Beth Din has a mitzvah then to carry out certain things on behalf of the nation. So when they appoint a shaliach, an agent, to do something, the agent could be called a shliach of the Beth Din, but by extension, they become a shliach of the nation. We have an example of this in our daily services. There's a shliach tzibur, somebody leading the service. And that person leading the service is actually empowered by or representing the congregation that's gathered. What happens if the chazan doesn't do his job? Right. The tzibur, the congregation, the community loses. Whatever, he does his job well. Everybody's enriched. So you need to understand that this is a national mitzvah. It's a mitzvah that's done on behalf of the nation. The Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, is going to be responsible. Does that mean that the sage or venerable head of the Sanhedrin has to go and get involved in the reaping? The answer is no. There's some mitzvahs that have to be done by the person who is responsible, and some mitzvahs that you can appoint a shaliach for. So, for example, if the Sanhedrin makes a very, very big mistake and they give bad instructions to the nation and everybody does something wrong because they were misinformed, who's responsible? The Sanhedrin is responsible. And the Sanhedrin has to bring a korban. And who has to be there to represent the Sanhedrin? The head of the Sanhedrin. He has a job to do. He can't send an agent. But this is not a mitzvah that he has to do by himself. This is the responsibility of the Sanhedrin to make sure it gets done. So the Sanhedrin functioned. And they would appoint people. They would send somebody. Shluchei Beis Din would say, we are here to represent the nation. We are doing this on behalf of the nation. By the way, this is not an actual mitzvah. This is at best what we would call in today's day and age a hechsher mitzvah. It's a preparation for a mitzvah. The word kosher means prepared, not blessed. So if something is properly prepared, then it's appropriate or suitable. So they were making things suitable because things had to be done in a certain way. Why was it important to do this as quickly as possible? Who cares if it took a little longer? That's a good question. So some of the Mefarshim say that the reason they wanted to do this as quickly as possible was because there was a lot of work to be done with these fresh granola stalks to make them suitable for flour. And then to grind the flour and sift the flour, it could take all night. And they would be really under the gun, pressed, hard pressed to get things done. And we wouldn't want to delay things one nanosecond extra because there was hungry people waiting to be fed and the fresh grain couldn't be eaten. So we needed to bring this korban. We had an obligation to bring this korban as soon as possible because of hungry people, which is pretty interesting. Is there a specified quantity? There is a specified quantity. But the specified quantity is in the Mishnah, not in the Torah itself. And there's a discussion whether or not, if the day after Pesach was Shabbat, whether or not they cut as much or they cut just the bare minimum. But yes, I mean, the simple answer is you need to get an omer. Right? And the question is, how much grain do you need for an omer? That's not simple. It's hard to quantify. Today, probably with artificial intelligence, you could figure it out more quickly. But in those days, they probably made more flour than they needed to be sure that they had enough to fill the omer. So that's I just wanted to clarify. That's what the shluchi bezdin. So let's talk about now the bundle. Is there anything specific? Was it a big bundle? Was it a small bundle? So Rashi says something very interesting. Rashi is the small letters on the inside of the page. And it's not written in regular Hebrew letters, so you might have difficulty with it, but I'll read it for you. Rashi says, Korchin v'koshrin rosh hashibolim. The stalks were made at the head, not at the bottom, at the top of the stalk. And the stalks were made, says Rashi, milo egrof, a fistful. So a fistful, the shitu mekubetzet, which is printed right on the side of the Gemara, tells us, kimilo. Don't read it. It shouldn't be milo egrof, but kimilo egrof. Kimilo egrof means what you can grab with your fist. I guess you call it like a baseball. Why? Because if the stalk is made, think about it. You have these stalks. They're spread out in the bottom because each stalk needs its own little area to grow in. If one grows on top of the other, it's not healthy. So the stalks know, intuitively know, to give each other space. If only people would know how to do that. Right? Now we're trying to undo that organic separateness because we want this to be as easy as possible to cut. So the stalks would be brought together and you'd tie in unison enough for a person to grab on top with his fist because we're trying to make this easy. So instead of taking a whole bunch of grain like this, all you have to do is hold it on the top like this and then bring the sickle down. We didn't care about the whole stalk. We're not making hay. We're looking just for the actual stalks on top. So as long as you had enough of a fistful, you were able to grab this. If you can grab it, you can cut quickly. So they grab it, cut it. Grab it, cut it. And that's how the Shluchi Bezdin would perform the reaping. And the Gemara in the Mishnah says, this is Kedei Sheyehe Noach Liktzor, so that it would be easy to reap. Now, moving on, the Mishnah tells us something very interesting. Who was present at the time of the reaping? The Mishnah now has moved 24 hours, or probably 27 or 30 hours. Something was done Erev Yom Tov. The grain was still growing. Incidentally, in addition to the fact that the grain, by tradition, oral tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu, had to be cut the night before, even if it's Shabbat. We needed the grain to grow for as long as possible. 24 hours more in the ground makes a big difference, especially in that season, because it was very wet, very moist. And there's like a discussion of when we have a leap year. And one of the reasons for a possible adding the 13th month of the year, in which the lunar calendar and the solar calendar are justified because lunar months are only 29 and a half days, and it doesn't add up to 365 days, which is the lunar cycle or the seasonal cycle, the solar cycle. If you have 12 months that are 29 and a half days, which some months will have to be 29 days and some months will be 30 days, what you end up with is 354 days. You're 11 and a half days short. A year goes by, you're 11 and a half days off season. That's a problem. A second year goes by, now you're 23 days off season. A third year goes by, you're already well into the mid-30s. It's a big problem. 34 days into a different season. And that's why you'll hear that other faith systems or civilizations that have lunar calendars will have New Year's at all different times of the year. For example, the Muslim world just finished celebrating Ramadan. And the Ramadan follows their lunar calendar, but Ramadan is not necessarily in April. It can be any time of the year. In fact, it travels around the year. It keeps moving 10 days or 11 days back or 12 days back. That doesn't work for us. We have to have lunar months and a solar calendar, a seasonal calendar. And Pesach always has to come out in the spring. One of the reasons Pesach always has to be celebrated in the spring is because this fresh grain has to be brought as an offering. So if we see that the stalks haven't yet grown, we're not going to be able to do this mitzvah. You can't harvest these stalks prematurely. This is simply not edible. You can't make wheat out of it. Sorry, you can't make flour out of it, out of the barley. So because of this, and especially because of the likelihood of it not being ripe yet, leaving it for another 24 or 25 hours, leaving for another couple hours of sunlight, and then another whole day of sunlight, it makes a big difference. So we're going to cut it as late as possible. Of course, you could ask the question, why did you cut it the next morning? And the answer goes back to what we said before, because it takes a whole night of work to make sure it's ready for the next morning and people are hungry. So the beginning of the Mishnah is Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach is the 14th day of Nisan. However long it took to make the bundles, I'm sure that the Shluchei Bezdin knew what they were doing and they knew how much they would need. Maybe they made some extra, but they would make the necessary bundles, they'd tie the bundles, and they'd leave. Incidentally, they wouldn't always go to the same place. We'll talk about that later on. They would have to select a good field. Some fields are more quick to produce. Some fields are a little bit behind. Now we move forward into the night after Pesach. And the night after Pesach, the Mishnah tells us, people begin to gather. Presumably, before night falls, everybody has already gathered. So we're now in the late afternoon of the first day of Pesach, and we are gathering. The Mishnah says, Kol ha'ayarot hasmuchot l'sham, mitkansot l'sham. All of the townlets that are in the vicinity are now gathering round this field. In all likelihood, the cutting of the Omer was not taking place in the middle of a municipal area. That's not where you grow barley. This is not a cucumber patch. It's in a field. Fields generally are outside of municipal areas, especially in antiquity, where people lived oftentimes in walled cities for protection. There was all kinds of dangerous bands of robbers that roamed the countryside. So people would lock themselves in to be safe. The fields where they worked during the day, that was outside of the living area. In today's day and age, you can see this. I mean, you can see this when you drive outside the city and you start seeing the fields. But you can see this also. We have what's called industrial areas and residential areas. So this wasn't a residential area. So people would gather. All the closest cities would gather. People would come out. Why are all these people gathering? I know why the Shluchei Bezdin went out, because they're responsible to do this. Why are people gathering? This isn't their mitzvah. And the answer, says the Mishnah, is Kedei Shehei Niktzar Be'esek Gadol, so that this cutting should take place with lots of fanfare. It should be a big deal. And you know when things are a big deal? When there's lots of people. When there's a crowd. So there's a crowd. We're going to talk about this. Well, I'll share with you some very interesting reasons as to why there was a big crowd. I want to go through the Mishnah, and then I want to return to the Mishnah and start analyzing some details in this Mishnah. The Mishnah now says, Kevon Shehechashecho, once night fell, now that people have gathered from all sides, once night fell, Oymer Lohen, he would say to them. And the Mefarshim point out, he was singular. Singular mean the cutter, the reaper. Now we know from the other Mishnayot that there were three reapers. But the reapers themselves would speak. Each one would say, Bo HaShemesh, has the sun set? Which is a euphemism for has night fallen. Has night fallen? Omar, the people would say, Hin, yes, And he said again, Ba Shemesh, has night fallen? Or literally, has the sun come? Has it left? Omer Hin. He said, yes. So the obvious question is, why are the people going to be any smarter than the person who is standing with the sickle? I mean, if you're not sure if night fell, night probably didn't fall yet. And if you know night fell, what are you asking the people for? So Rashi says like this. Rashi says that this business of the people gathering from the townlets, Hamula Gedoyla, Rashi says, a great tumult. And the great tumult was about Sheyavinu Baisusim, so that the Baisusim or Baitusim should understand Shebematzoy Yomtif Kotzern Osan, that this harvesting, this reaping would take place on the night after Yom Tov. The Baisusim Loi Moide, because the Baisusim did not acknowledge this. Who are Baisusim or Baitusim? Why are we concerned with Baitusim say? We'll talk about this a little bit later. But first I want to go through the Mishnah, just so you get the basics. Omer Lehem, he says, who? Rashi says, HaKotzer, the reaper. Says Lebnei Ayarot, to the townspeople. The throngs of people, HaOmdot Olav, were standing all around him. Bo HaShemesh, has night fallen? Oh yeah, Omer Lehem. They would tell him, Hain, yes. And then he says, Magalzo, is this a sickle? People say, yeah, yeah, you got a sickle. He says, Magalzu, is this a sickle? He says, yeah, it's a sickle. And then he says, now I know it's a sickle. Magalzu, kilomar, as if to say, B'magalzu ektzer hatfur, says Rashi, should I use this sickle? Not, is this a sickle? You're holding the sickle. You're asking me what it is? He says, it's as if to say, should I use this sickle? What the heck is going on here, right? A little bit of patience. So let's just get through it, and then we're going to return, and we're going to understand everything that's going on here. And then he says, Kupazu, is this a container? A basket? As Rashi says, Etin hatvua, so I place the freshly cut, reaped grain inside this, and they would say, yep, it's a basket. It's a hin? It is. And the Mishnah adds, B'Shabbat, if Pesach fell on Friday and they were going into Shabbat, Omer Lehin would say to them, Shabbat Zo? Is it Shabbat? Omer Lehin, yeah, it's Shabbat. He said again, Shabbat Zo? Is it Shabbat? Rashi says, Kiloma, Ekzer B'Shabbat? Am I going to cut? Am I going to harvest, reap on Shabbat? You know how to reap on Shabbat.
The ceremony seems as important as the act itself.
It seems very, very important. And what the dickens is going on over here? Because we have the Shluchi Bezdin going out before to tie the bundles together so they should be cut quick. And all of a sudden, they seem to have all the time in the world. And they're asking superfluous questions. And there's like a whole give and take with the throngs of people and the people who were empowered by the Bezdin to perform the reaping. What's going on here? What is this? The Mishnah says, by the way, didn't just repeat themselves, but when they would say all of these things, they would say, Ektzar, should I cut? And they said, yeah, Himalay Ktzar, go ahead. Ektzar, should I reap? And they said, yeah, reap, Himalay Ktzar, reap. It wasn't twice. The Mishnah says, Shalosh Pa'amim, three times. Each of these things would be repeated thrice. Al kol davar v'davar, on each one of these things, hayu omrim le hin. He would say, is it night? Yeah, it is. It's night. Is it night? Yeah, it's night. What's going on over here? What is this? So the Mishnah asks this question. Kol kach lama. Lama li, what am I doing this for? What is this whole ceremonious questions and answers that seem to mean actually nothing? And the Mishnah says, Mipnei habaisusim. This is because of the Batuthians. Shayoimrim, that they used to say, Ein ketzira ta'omer b'matzor yom tov. We don't cut the omer on the night of Yom Tov. The omer is cut, they would say, on matzoi Shabbat. Because the Torah says, the day after Shabbat, they would say it has to be done on a Saturday night. It's got to be brought on a Sunday, not the day after Pesach. Who are the Bahuthians? Why do we care about the Bahuthians? What is going on over here?
Have they come up somewhere before?
So actually, you know the Bahuthians better as Sadducees. And there's a crossover. These were two different groups that weren't far apart. And I'm going to try and explain everything that we just learned in this Mishnah because it sounds a little wacky right now. Okay, so let's return to the Mishnah, and I want to point something out before we even start. When something is used for temple service, it has to be consecrated. This is called making something hegdish. Kadosh, organically speaking, holy in Hebrew, kadosh means. What does it mean?
Aside from holy?
Yeah, what is really the origin of the word holy? So most people say holy, but it doesn't really work because in Hebrew, words always have etymology. So here's something that'll really shock and surprise you. There is a certain profession that is inherently defining for the person. They call the person by this profession. And it's the oldest profession, unfortunately, or so it's referred to. A harlot, a person who receives funds for intimate conduct or favors. And it could be done, a woman is called a prostitute, the male is called a gigolo, but the people who will, you know, they'll hire for themselves for this service. You know what they're called in Hebrew? The male is called a kodesh, and the woman is called a kadesha. There is nothing holy about prostitution. It's a terrible thing. It's entirely immoral, beyond the pale from a Jewish perspective. So why do we call them holy? And the answer is, we don't. But the word holy means designated or set apart. So something that is taken out of circulation, that's the meaning of holy. For example, a person might dedicate an animal as an offering. So to dedicate an animal as an offering, does he have to go to school? Does he have to get smicha? Take the goat, put him in a school, teach him aleph beis. And the goat has a long beard, he's a big chassid. Now he's wise. Oh, now we give the ordained the goat as a holy goat because he's very wise and learned and pious. And of course, that's ridiculous. How could a goat do that? So how does the goat become a korban? You have to be makdish the korban, which means I have to designate that this animal is going to be used for that purpose. By the way, once you designate an animal for a sacred purpose, no one is ever allowed to benefit from it again. Why? Because it has been taken out of circulation. It has been dedicated and designated for a sacred purpose. It doesn't have to be an animal. It could be a plant. A plant whose vegetation is dedicated for a sacred purpose. It could be an object. Once it's dedicated for use in the Beit HaMikdash, no one is allowed to use it again, ever. In fact, it's considered a grave sin. It's a violation of this basic bond that we have with God. When we dedicate something to God, then it's holy. An example of this we could find in holy artifacts that we use in today's day and age. For example, a bag in which tefillin are placed, but it's made only for tefillin. And it's not made for anything else. It's not a wallet. It's made only for tefillin. Can you use that bag for something else? The answer is no. Imagine, if you can, that you would see somebody take the parchment of a Sefer Torah and use it for, you know, a lampshade. Just use it for some. What would you call it? This is an act of sacrilege. Why? It's an old Torah, so, you know, we have to recycle. No, we don't do that. Why not? What's wrong with recycling? This is sacred. Sacred. Sacred means that the Torah is revered like a human being. So when it becomes old and no longer usable, what do we do with it? We lay it to rest like a human being. Why? Because it's different. It's different. It's out of circulation. In the same way that people who are entirely not involved in any kind of faith, they would not be comfortable purchasing a pair of shoes made out of human skin? I don't think so. They don't care if it's pig skin. They don't care if it's goat skin. They don't care. They don't care. That's fine. But imagine if people would say, yeah, yeah, this is human. This is a great football. It's made of a human. How would people react? That's horrible. Why? What, do you want to waste a person? Hey, the person's dead anyway. May as well use him. Chop him up. Use him. That's like, that's macabre. That's sick. Why? Because we see human life as sacred, and that which contains human life is also sacred. So because a body contains the holiest thing in the world, a neshama, it's also sacred. And human remains are sacred, and cemeteries are sacred, and places where people were killed are sacred. It's sacred. So anything which is used to conduct holiness or designated for a holy purpose becomes sacred. Namely, it's taken out of circulation. I mean use. It's not in use anymore. So for example, sometimes money is taken out of circulation. Why? Because let's say it's old or something's wrong, and you actually have to go to the bank and you give them your ruined paper money or your coin, and they'll give you a new coin, but they'll take it out of circulation. Why? Because it's no longer usable. So when I mean circulation, I mean it's not part of the currency of our everyday life anymore. Okay. So now that we understand this, when did people, for example, sanctify the goat that they were going to use as a Korban Pesach, an Erev Pesach? If they would sanctify the goat when they were in Metula, and then they have to travel all the way south to get to Jerusalem, you know, it's really hard to handle an animal and never use them. Because if the animal is plodding along as you're walking a few days to Jerusalem, and you place a package on the animal, you just violated this mitzvah because it's a sacred animal. You're not allowed to use it. So when did they actually formally declare it sacred? The answer is outside the Temple Mount. When they would come up to the outer areas of the Temple Mount, which are not sacred, for example, the area on the south of the Temple Mount elevations that today houses the largest mosque in the world, the Black Al-Aqsa Mosque, the largest mosque in the world. That was built in recent times, because Israel doesn't have any religious freedom for anybody else, right? They took out landfill. 20,000 tractors of landfill were taken, were carved out. 20,000 tractors. Now, it's not sacred. The Temple Mount is a much smaller area. This was all built up during the period of the latter period of the First Temple and very much during the Second Temple. In a strange way, our enemies did us a huge favor. We would never have touched that space, never have touched that soil, but we found thousands of artifacts, which of course all prove that, you know, emet me eretz titzmach, the truth comes right out of the ground. You see Jewish artifacts going back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years. It's coming out of the ground. And there's a site where all this was dumped. And the Antiquities Authority of Israel said, you know what? We should be going through that stuff. So they started going through it. And it's unbelievable. Arrowheads and coins, all kinds of different layers and you know, different times. So there was something called Shari Chulda. Shari Chulda are gates that burrow through that landfill. They're still there now. We Jewish people, we don't go there, but they're still there. These tunnels, they were never destroyed by the Romans. And the people would come up, they would go through these long tunnels. And one of the reasons that we believe they're called Shari Chulda is because they're like weasels tunnels. They would come up and you'd come out on the Temple Mount panorama. But it wasn't yet sacred. And at that point, you would declare your animal to be sacred. Because you're not allowed to bring chulin into the Azara. You're not allowed to bring a non-sacred animal into the Beis HaMikdash. You know, they bring an animal that's sacred. When does it, and how does it become sacred? When you declare it to be sacred. So the question then is, how does a Jew make it sacred? The answer is with the power of a speech. He says, Harei ze hegdash, Harei ze korban. This is a korban. This is sacred. The flour that would be brought into the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to bring chulin. You're not allowed to bring mundane things into the Beis HaMikdash. It has to be sacred. How did it become sacred? They would declare it to be sacred. So now is the question, when Bezdin would make a little bundle, was that act an act of designation? Did it actually become sacred? Interesting question. On one hand, it seems that Bezdin designated this for use, then it became sacred. So,
in effect, done the mitzvah?
So that's a very good question. It's a very good question, doctor. The simple answer is that certain mitzvot require more than intention, but there has to be also articulation. So, for example, when a Jew would designate firstling fruit to be brought to the Beit HaMikdash, this is called the mitzvah of Bikurim, which comes from the word Bechor, or firstborn. It says very clearly that the person would mark the first blossom, because how are you going to know later? But the first blossom that appears, you would tie a little thread or wrap a little piece of India rubber on it, and you would verbalize and say, Harei Zeh Hegdish, Harei Zeh Bikurim, this is Bikurim. So you have to verbalize it. Now the question is, when you do an action, which is an expression of an intention, but there's no verbalization, did it actually sanctify these stalks for a holy purpose? Were they cutting Hegdish? So the Yerushalmi in Mesechet Shkolim tells us very clearly that they would designate the flower as sacred on the day of the Korban, not the night before, and certainly not a day and a half before. So at the time of the cutting, they weren't holy. What we must then say then, this is why the Mishnah makes a point of saying, what would the agents of the Beth Din do? They would go out from Erev Yom Tov, v'osin otan krichot. And why would they do it? The Mishnah is very clear to point out, not to designate it as holy, but rather, k'dei she'yeh noach, so that it should be easy to do. It should be easy to cut. In fact, in some of the commentaries, there's a suggestion that it would only be made holy after it was already in flower form. Because handling holy stuff is a little scary. You might use it. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And the bottom line is that there is even a proof, there's a proof of this, that in fact this is the case. Nachmanides comments on the words in the Torah that speak about the mitzvah of cutting this first grain. It's found in Leviticus 23, Parshas Emor. So over there, it's juxtaposed to the leaving of the edge of the field for the poor, which is called peah. Mistranslated as corner, means edge. The outer rim, the outer edge is called peah. Now, it's referred to as peah to remind us that the Ktzira Ta'omer does not override the mitzvah of peah. So a person says, hey, my barley is going to be brought as a korban. I'm not giving anything to the poor. I'm selling to them. I'm doing business with the Beis HaMikdash. I'm a purveyor to the temple. You know, like you have these Canadian products as purveyor to her majesty used to say, well, now we'll be to his majesty, the king or the queen, whatever, the Buckingham Palace, purveyor of. Or you have in Canada, like the official drink of the Blue Jays or whatever, like I'm the man or the woman. Hey, we're the field. Imagine what a great advertisement that was when you sold flour. It was like that was the greatest ad. Get flour from the temple fields. We got the best barley this year. How do you know? How do you know? Because when the temple looked for barley, where'd they go? We must have the best barley. Maybe that brand was called Temple Barley or something. I don't know. Migdash Malt. It was like everybody was going crazy for this stuff, right? This is great. So a person will say, I'm not going to give it to the poor. I'm a Beit HaMikdash guy. Ah, Nachmanides says, that's very nice. Beit HaMikdash. You can tell whoever you want and use it in your marketing campaign, but don't think that you're exempt from giving to the poor. Now, if it belonged to the Beit HaMikdash, it would be exempt. Because that mitzvah is a mitzvah that's incumbent upon us as individuals. It's not a Mikdash mitzvah. It's not God's mitzvah, it's our mitzvah. And because it's our mitzvah, from this we can prove that the field that was being cut was not a temple field. And that the stalks of barley that were being reaped were not going to be already made sacred, but rather stalks of barley, which would be made sacred after they were roasted and ground and sifted, and it becomes flour. So that's the first interesting thing I thought was worthy of pointing out. That's in the day before Pesach. Now let's go back to the Mishnah. Let's go a little further than the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that people would gather, and the Rashi is very clear about this. Rashi says, you know why the people would gather? the people would gather because of the Baituthians, who we still don't know who they are, these phantom Baituthians. We'll get to them soon. So I always had a problem with this, and I actually found the Mefarshim speak about it. My problem was that I had the privilege of teaching classes on Megillat Rut, and I went through the verses very, very carefully. And when Rut and Naomi arrive in Israel, coming from the land of Moab, when they come to Eretz Yisrael, they come to Beit Lechem. Now, Beit Lechem in the Torah is the same place called Bethlehem today. That's what, you know, it's not a Christian site, it's not a Muslim site, it's an ancient Jewish site. It's in our scripture. Before there was a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, Beit Lechem is mentioned. And King David's family comes from Beit Lechem. Boaz, the grandfather of David HaMelech, is the judge in Beit Lechem. And the Sanhedrin of the Jewish people was situated at the gates of Beit Lechem. Now, Beit Lechem, which very interestingly means the house of bread. Lechem is bread. This was an area in which there were many fertile fields. Elsewhere, it's referred to as the Kidron region. In today's day and age, the name Kidron has survived. It's the name of the valley that's found on the east side of the Temple Mount. It's called the Kidron Valley. If you look to the north, you'll see the Mount of Olives. If you look a little further to the south, on the east side, you'll see a huge empty valley. Fascinatingly, nobody has ever built anything there. Why? It's very valuable land. We believe that's because Beis HaMikdash material was there. And it's sacred. And Hashem made sure that nobody built anything there, and I don't believe anybody will build anything there. There's ancient tombs over there. There's a Byzantine house of worship, which in all likelihood is on the site of where they used to bring the Para Aduma. That's just my personal theory, but usually whenever you look at houses of worship were built on the site of older houses of worship. An old house of worship, there was a reason they revered their spot. And where would it have begun? With the Jewish people. What was on the Kidron Valley? Well, the Kidron Valley, that's where the Para Aduma, the red heifer, was brought. So it's called Kidron region. And we know that the scripture tells us, and the Medrash is very, very clear about this, that when Naomi and Ruth came, they found this enormous amount of people. When did they come? When did they come to Israel? They walked from Moab. When did they come? They left the morning of Pesach. They left after the Seder. There was a Seder, and this was Naomi's goodbye to Moab. Naomi's going home. And her daughters-in-law picked up on what was going on, and she tried to leave the house early in the morning, and they ran out, and they said, where are you going? And she said, you know, I'm old, I'm lost, everybody's dead, you stay here. And Orpah says, okay. In the end, she's persuaded that she stays there, and she goes on a crazy orgy after, and Goliath ends up being born of that union. Ruth says, no, where you go, I will go. Your nation is my nation. She follows Naomi, and they walk all the way to Israel. And it's a long day. It's a whole long day. And they come at the night, in the evening, and they find huge throngs of people. Where are the throngs of people? In Beit Lechem. Why are they in Beit Lechem? Because the Omer is about to be cut. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no Baituthians. The Baituthians, I'm going to soon share, only show up during the Hellenistic period, in the Second Temple era. So Rashi says that the whole tumult is made because of Baituthians, including the large crowds, but the Medrash seems to say a little bit different. It's very possible that Rashi is telling us during the Second Temple era they would emphasize the crowds and even push the crowds, and it was part of the anti-Baituthian movement. Okay, but I just want to point out that the Medrash clearly says that there was large gatherings. So why would there be large gatherings? So we, up until now, we've been talking about this concept of large gatherings because we had to show up the Baituthians. So the Sefer HaChinuch uses a very interesting expression. The Sefer HaChinuch says that the reason we get a crowd is because we should do a mitzvah. He says, mitoch ha-ma'aseh v'ha-simcha. because it's joyous. A lot of people there. It's nice. It's happy. Everybody's uplifted. A little quiet thing. Nobody is there. It's not. It's like lackluster. You know, people say it was a good party. Who was there? It was just me, but it was a good party. That's not a party. But you have a grand ceremony and you have things going on and a lot of people are there. It's like a wow, right? So there was a wow factor. And this is articulated by other Mefarshim who emphasize the concept of Berov Am Hadrat Melech. When there is a large crowd, it glorifies the king. It gives glory to the king. And in general, in Yiddishkeit, there's an emphasis on doing things in a crowd. Because it makes it important. Some even maintain that counting of the Omer is traditionally done in the Beit HaKnesset and Shul after Ma'ariv, where there's a crowd. Even though it's a personal mitzvah. We should do it together as a community, because ideally you do this in a crowd and it becomes more meaningful. So this is some of the reasoning that goes behind the crowd. Now Rashi says the ultimate reason for the crowd is the Bituthians, but there's something more to the crowd than simply a question of Bituthian. All right, who are these Bituthians and what in heaven is going on with them? So let me introduce you to them. From a Torah source, of course, right? So we're going to go to the Torah source. So in Avos de Reb Nosson, which is the codicil of Pirkei Avot, much, much larger, much, much longer than Pirkei Avot. But in the codicil of Pirkei Avot, near the end of the fifth chapter, there is a repetition of the teaching of Antigonus Ish Socho. Now, Antigonus, which is a Greek name, was a great leader of the Jewish people after Simon the Just, Shimon HaTzadik. When does Shimon HaTzadik live? For reasons of following the calendar or the timeline in today's day and age, most people are more familiar with Alexander the Great than they are with Shimon HaTzadik. Let's just say when Alexander marched on Jerusalem, it was Shimon who confronted him. Alexander had intention to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. He did not. There were enemies of the Jewish people called Kuthim. They tried to get the Beit HaMikdash destroyed. They were fake converts. They used to worship some kind of winged idol, a bird idol, and the Kuthim were not real Jews. So bottom line is, the Jewish people are saved. Who comes after Shimon HaTzadik? Antigonus. So this is in the post-Hellenic period, because Hellenism swept across the Western world, as it was called at the time. All the pagan rites and the pagan civilization crumbled before the force of Hellenism. And it's true that the Romans eventually defeated the Greeks, but that was on the battlefield, militarily. If you think about it, culturally, the Greeks defeated the Romans because the Romans just became Greek. They absorbed their culture, they Romanized some of the names, but they took all their gods and all their, it was basically all their philosophy. The difference was that the Greek rulers, the Greek monarchs as a rule, were philosophically inclined. Alexander was a great philosopher. You know who his teacher was? His private tutor for 3 years, Aristotle. Philip of Macedonia hired a young philosopher named Aristotle to teach his son. So Alexander's a very smart man. The Roman Caesars were brutes. They were not known for philosophy or wisdom, with one exception. That's Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. And according to the Gemara, he is the one Caesar who had very cordial relationships with the Jewish people and a very, very close relationship with the leader of the Jewish people, the redactor of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. So he wrote a book of philosophy. He was the only philosopher king the Romans had. They weren't philosophers. They were philosophers, they were warriors. Brutal, brutes, brutal people. But at any rate, the Hellenist period has a profound impact in Israel as well. And the Jewish people were this leadership of the Jewish people, the Torah leadership was fighting against these influences. We're trying to retain the youth. The youth were enchanted with Hellenism. By the time the story of Hanukkah happens, most of the Jewish people are not interested in Judaism anymore. They're interested in Hellenism. Everybody thinks it was a war of the Jewish people against the Assyrian Greeks. No. It was a civil war, tragically. Many, many, many of the locals had no interest in Maccabees or Hashmonaim. So where does this really begin? It says that Antigonus, says the Avestha of Nason, had two disciples. And they took his teachings out of context. And they said, what is Antigonus teaching us? He teaches us that we should serve God. Don't serve the teacher in order to get a reward. Serve the master out of love. And they said, so there is no reward. So there is no consequence. So there is no world to come. Antigonus said it. And they said, in that case, nothing makes a difference. So what are we doing? This is nuts. Why should we restrain ourselves and refrain from all kinds of behavior and toil? Let's have a good time. There's no consequence. Amdu upirshu min haTorah. They separated themselves from the Torah. V'nifritzu mehem shtei pratzes. From these disciples who, as the Mishnah tells us, one of them is called Tzaddik and one of them is called Baisus. So Tzaddik and Baisus rose and they each founded their own atheistic or agnostic kind of Judaism. Their own reformed Judaism. One was called Sadducees, Tzedukim, and one was called Baisusim, Batuthians. Al Shum Tzaddik and Baisusim, Al Shum Baisus. Vahi Mishtamshim, Bichli Chesef, Bichli Zov, Kol Yemeim. They used, so to speak, gold and silver. They enjoyed life. That's what the Mishnah is saying. They didn't believe that anything really made a difference. And there is no world to come. They were what we call in the modern day and age, nihilists. You know what nihilism is? So nihilism means nothing matters. Nothing matters. And nihilism comes from the term of nihil in Greek or Latin, which means zero. I actually was curious about this, so I did a little Google, and nihilism, from Latin, nihil mean nothing, is a philosophy or family of views within a philosophy that rejects generally accepted fundamental aspects of human existence, such as an objective truth, knowledge, morality, values, meaning. None of that. Who popularized this term? Believe it or not, it's a very, very modern term. It was only popularized in the 19th century by a Russian writer named Ivan Turgenev. In case you're curious, Ivan Turgenev was a very, very talented writer and a poet and a playwright and a brilliant man, was also a raving anti-Semite. He hated the Jewish people with a passion. And in his writings, there is venomous descriptions of the Jewish figure. For example, the story he published in 1847 called The Jid, which is a pejorative for the Jew. So this is what nihilism is, and it's a very empty, dissolute approach to life. And these people said, there is nothing. So let's have fun. Now, Rambam, Maimonides, in his commentary on the Mishnah, says something very interesting. He kind of develops what the Avestha of Nason says. He says, yeah, well, there was these two disciples, and they said there is no consequence. Nothing matters. There is no meaning. There's no objective truth. Nothing matters. There's no hope. There's nothing. Life is no meaning. Life is purposeless. It's just enjoy yourself. And they denied the Torah. But they didn't want to do this by themselves. They infected other people. They gathered large crowds around them. The thing is that efshar lehem lerakezus ha'amonim, they couldn't capture the masses, sovav ha'amuno shehusko lehem. Their faith was, they were just agnostics or atheists. They didn't believe in anything. But that's not a faith. Atheism wasn't that popular. People weren't prepared to renounce faith in God altogether, live meaningless lives. Lefi shoha emuna hara hazu mafrida bein hamuchadim. It doesn't bring about unity. It brings about disunity. Why should I be kind to you? Why should I be compassionate? Why should I be sensitive? You mean nothing. You're a collection of tissue. You're nothing. Nothing means anything. So you can't hammer together a following with that kind of philosophy. So therefore, they said, okay, fine. Have some Judaism. But you know what? We cut and paste. We tailor. We add, subtract. whatever is convenient. It was called the Judaism of convenience. Fun Judaism. Let's make it work. It's cultural. Cultural Judaism. Sure, we believe in Judaism. Of course. Ah, you don't have to leave your Judaism, but you can have your cake and eat it too. So you can be Jewish and have fun. Do whatever you want. We deem lobster to be kosher today. Oh, great. I'm so glad it's kosher. So this is what the Bituvians were about. And the Bituvians had this idea that, first of all, they rejected the holiday of Shavuot. Why did they reject the holiday of Shavuot? Because Shavuot is Matan Torah. So Rosh Hashanah is cultural, you know, you can have this legend about the Adam and Eve and whatever, and everybody needs a restart. Okay, so a September restart. Sukkot is they call it the harvest festival. You go out, it's at the booth, as long as it's comfortable. Okay. Passover is a story, some kind of mumbo jumbo. It never really happened, but it's a cute story about liberation and slaves. It's about freedom. Matan Torah doesn't have a matzah or a sukkah. It's got no mitzvahs, like the Rebbe Yitzchak Baditshever famously says. Why is it that Shavuot has no specific mitzvah attached to it? There's no lulav and etrog, there's no matzah. Why? He says, very simple, because this represents the essence of God's bond with the Jewish people. This represents revelation, and specifically the revelation of the oral Torah, the oral tradition. So the Bituvians said, we don't buy into that.
So their insistence that, according to the writing, that it was on the first night after the Yom Tov.
Why?
It wasn't that day was important for them, it's just that it shouldn't be where...
They said, we have to have a long weekend. So it's comfortable to have a long weekend. So it's like in today's day and age, sometimes they say...
That was an important thing.
They said, it wasn't really important. It's a long weekend.
So all of the repetition and the ceremony is really for our benefit.
Aha. Because we are emphasizing to strengthen our commitment and make it very public. Is this it? Understand? That's why we do this whole... And the Mefarshim say, very interesting, why do we say, is this a sickle? Say yes. Is this... But then we say, should I cut? Three times. Why? Because when it comes to things, all things Jewish, we do things three times, especially when it's public. It's public. So there's like a number of Rishonim, like Rabbeinu Yonah and the Rosh, who say that on Yom Kippur night, the reason we say Kol Nidre three times is because making a public declaration. So you do it publicly, you can do it three times. And some trace the origin of this to Elijah, who makes this public demonstration of God's holiness versus the Baal, what he faces off the Baal. So it says he pours water over his offering three times. And then he cries out three times, Hashem hu elikim, Hashem hu elikim, Hashem. So this is a whole business of thrice, that from Eliyahu HaNavi pouring the water three times, that's where we have this idea of doing something in a public way three times makes it really permanent. And the idea of chazakah, of something assuming to be so, is also related to three times. So Zalman is asking, because we sanctify the item for the service of the Beit HaMikdash, we can use it to reap even on Shabbat? So no, Zalman, that's not actually correct. It's not actually correct. And we didn't sanctify it. We didn't sanctify it. And you're asking whether or not we're allowed to do malacha, allowed to do work on Shabbat in the Beit HaMikdash. So first of all, we're allowed to do work on Shabbat when it's a mitzvah. So on the eighth day, when it's a mitzvah to have a brit milah, we're not allowed to cut flesh or perform surgery on Shabbat. But if it's the eighth day and that's the mitzvah, then yes, we're allowed to do it. And here the mitzvah is to bring a korban on the day after Pesach, whether it's Shabbat or Tuesday. And therefore, we have no choice but to cut it the night before, because we have a whole night of work of roasting and grinding to be able to turn it into flour. So this whole tumult was made to rule out the Bituvians, to make it very clear that no, the Bituvians are wrong. By the way, we're going to learn in next episode, this was all about a long weekend for them. So if we start counting Sundays, so then we'll get a long weekend, then we can have a holiday weekend, like in today's day and age, where they schedule official holidays on the weekend. You know, in Canada, the May 2-4 weekend. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to happen. They have to make it convenient. This was a Judaism of convenience. So in case you think that people who want to have a convenient Judaism is a new phenomenon, it's as old as the Second Temple itself. Now the interesting thing is that the Rambam, in Hilchos Tmidim U'Musafin, the Rambam seems to say that this is the halacha. And the question is, when Mashiach will come and we'll start to do these mitzvot again, there won't be any Bituvians. or their ears. So it's hard to understand it. Rambam says we started to do it during the second Beis Hamikdash. So maybe one answer is that once we started to do this, this became the custom. And once that became the custom, that's what we continue to do. Or another answer is we don't know when Mashiach comes. We don't know what's going to happen. And maybe there will still be some confused people in the beginning. At any rate, this became the practice and the custom. I don't know if it was still by Tudians by the end of the second Beit Hamikdash, but this is what we did. Now, what's the difference between Bitudians and Sadducees? There's a whole Tosfos Yom Tov says that the Sadducees they led the charge in certain areas, and the Bitudians led the charge in other areas, and sometimes they're interchangeable, Tzedukim and Bisusim, but this was a Bisusi thing. Just the long weekend was a Bisusi thing. They were into the long weekend. that was their gig. So this is the Mishnah. This is the Mishnah. So now we know this is called the reaping. Now you know the reaping. We now have a basis for the preparations for the korban that's going to be brought in the Beis Hamikdash on the next day. And in our next episode, we're going to talk about Days of Glory, something called Megillas Tainus, a fascinating scroll which documented special days where great miracles and victories happened for Torah Judaism. And of those days, the only days we have left are Purim and Hanukkah. But at any rate, we will continue this series. And after we come to Days of Glory, we will eventually reach the actual counting, which is connected to the Omer offering. I hope you found this informative and uplifting and enjoyable. And I hope everybody will come back again, come back for more. If you haven't yet, please hit subscribe right under the screen. Just hit subscribe and enable notifications. Thank you for joining tonight. Have a beautiful evening, and may we merit to see the rebuilding of the third Beis Hamikdash, and Amir Tzah Hashem, the counting of the Omer, Min HaTorah, Bimheira, Obi Amenu, speedily and in our days. Amen. Laila Tov.